You are listening to WPVMLP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on the dial, heard globally on WPVMFM.org and on Alexa. Just tell Alexa to play WPVM Radio.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Anna Moran. She's a foreign policy expert with a decade of experience advocating on humanitarian crises and development needs in conflict-affected settings. She currently serves as the Director of Global Policy and Advocacy at the humanitarian NGO Med Global. Anna Moran, welcome to A Better World.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the work of Med Global, could you tell us about your background and how you came to work for Med Global?
Yeah, so I've spent my entire career working for humanitarian NGOs and civilian protection groups working on conflict settings and refugee crises. So as I said, previously worked at the IRC, one of the world's largest humanitarian NGOs, and now I'm working at Med Global, which is a newer NGO that works in to provide health assistance around the world.
So tell us about Med Global, what it is, and what its mission is.
Yeah, so Med Global is a U.S.-based humanitarian NGO that works in about a dozen conflicts and refugee-hosting states around the world, where we provide health and nutrition assistance. So we're working in the conflict hotspots in places like Gaza, Sudan, and Lebanon now, as well as some of the protracted refugee crises like in Bangladesh or in Colombia, supporting Venezuelans that have been displaced.
And when did it get started?
In 2017. So we're a newer organization.
Tell us about the people who started it and what their aim was for the organization.
Yeah. So I think one thing that makes Med Global, I think, very special is that it's started by doctors. And if you look at our board of directors and our leadership, is very much still led by doctors and other medical experts. And many of them actually volunteer themselves and go on medical missions to Ukraine, to Syria, to these other places to perform surgeries or trainings. So we were co-founded by two doctors in the U.S., Dr. Zahir Salul, originally from Syria, who now lives in the U.S., and John Kaler, an American physician. So two of them kind of co-founded it based on kind of gaps that they were seeing in medical needs in Bangladesh and Syria and other contexts.
How do you go about recruiting doctors, or do you have to recruit, or they just come to you of their own accord?
So we have, around the world, we have established programs inside these countries. So in places like Gaza, for example, we have almost 400 staff, all Palestinian staff that work for us and our partners on the ground. And so we'll have established teams in each of those countries where we work. And then in addition to that, something that's more unique to Med Global is that we work with this global roster of doctors who will volunteer their time with us, take a leave from the hospitals and the health sites where they're working in the U.S., in the U.K., in other countries, and will come with us on medical missions into these countries. In places like Gaza, or Sudan, where there's active war, there's huge gaps and needs. Doctors have been displaced. People, new health, clinics need to be stood up in places where, refugees or displaced people are arriving. In those contexts, they'll be actually doing like surgeries every day and trying to help with that backlog of cases and emergency needs that are coming in. In other places that are more stable or places where there is more of a health system that is being rebuilt and can recover, a lot of what we do is trainings. So, for example, I was in Ukraine last fall with one of our teams where they're training Ukrainian medics and surgeons from the front lines on how to respond to drone warfare and some of the really unique injuries that they're seeing in Ukraine. And so we will recruit experts from the US and other countries to come in. We'll bring those surgeons in to provide their expertise. People who have, some of them have served in like the US military, you know, they've served in ERs around the US. They have really specialized expertise on amputations or chemical warfare and different areas. And they'll come in to help train these doctors on how to respond to the really different kinds of medical needs that you see in a conflict zone that these doctors may not have been trained for or prepared for before that.
What was that like for you when you went to Ukraine?
I think every time I've gone to one of these conflict zones or sites, I think it's hard to be prepared, I think, for that. I think in Ukraine, you know, going with this team, you know, it wasn't in the, you know, in the front lines, but you go to places like Kyiv, where you have the air raids and sirens going every day. And kind of without warning, is all of a sudden you have the app on your phone goes off, or you hear the sirens in the air. And you are very aware of, like, you know, you're only there for a few days and it's jarring. And you realize what it has to be like to live through that every day, every week, every month, to do that for years of just every single day, not knowing if there's going to be an attack or a strike where you are. And got to meet some incredible, like, Ukrainian, you know, doctors that are working on the front lines that are really working in the most, I think, unimaginable conditions. And it's relevant, I think, again, as we think about what's happening in the Middle East, but a lot of what they talked about, a lot of what we were training on was the drone warfare, where they're seeing these much more complex injuries, much more devastating injuries from drone warfare, because they have these smaller drones that will hit people, you know, closer. They're at close impact injuries. It's most, you know, multiple parts of people's bodies are affected. It burns, blasts, people need amputations. It's much more serious injuries than even these doctors would typically be seeing in a conflict. And then on top of that, because of the way there are Russian drones in the air constantly, and that airspace is constantly dominated by them, they're not able to do traditional medical evacuation. And so for all the high tech that we have, like, you can't send in like a helicopter or, you know, a plane to evacuate these people from the front lines, even an ambulance going in. Those are pretty easy targets to hit. And so you have these emergency injuries where people should be getting treated within hours. And we have to train these doctors on, like, how do you keep a patient alive for multiple days or a week or 2 weeks or a month before they might be able to get evacuated? And these are people that in the U.S. would be in the ER immediately, you know, in the ICU. We're talking about the worst possible injuries. Mm-hmm. And so it's just people who are having to work with the absolute, you know, bare bones and not get to be able to do the care, the equipment that they should have because of the way the war that is being fought. And that's something that's all being replicated to the Middle East. And we're seeing that drone warfare again. We're seeing hospitals being hit. So those first responders are having to work in pretty unimaginable conditions.
How do you, as Med Global, decide about which countries to go to? Is it by invitation, or do you contact the country's governments?
It's a great question. So it's a combination. I mean, really, I think first and foremost, it's identifying, like, where do we have a value add? And so, I mean, that's something that I have really loved about, you know, coming to Med Global and the model is that oftentimes, like, in these places, we're not running, you know, a huge number of, like, Med Global branded hospitals and health clinics and trying to have, like, a permanent presence forever. It really is identifying, like, what is our value add, and where possible, how can we help support the local system to recover? So how are we training local doctors? How are we doing supply chain and bringing the medical equipment they need, the tools they need to be able to run the response? And so it's really trying to identify that gap that we can fill, but having be led by the local system. And so we work really closely with governments, you know, pretty much everywhere where we work, and, like, where possible, that's always the best model so that it can be, like, a government-led response. And so almost everywhere we work, we are working in a partnership with that Ministry of Health, with those local health systems, and go through this normal, like, registration in those countries, you know, and getting approvals where you can. And obviously there are places that, you know, during Syria, during the civil war, you know, other places where that's not the model that works, but in most places, that's what we try to do. So that's what we're doing in Lebanon. It's what we're doing in Ukraine. You know, in most places we come in a partnership with the government and say, here are the trainings we can provide. These are the services that we can do, and work in partnership with them to define kind of how we can help support that recovery or help support that emergency response.
So are there particular requirements, say, that a country has to agree to, perhaps, like, ensure safety of people before Med Global agrees to enter?
So unfortunately, with the way that wars are fought, if I think that was a requirement, there'd be a lot of places that wouldn't have aid workers. So first and foremost, it's always going to be about humanitarian need. Like, you go where there are the most needs, where there are gaps, where you can provide that value add. And so I would say, like, having that government partner, I think, is never a barrier for humanitarians. But it's always ideal if you can have that partner. What's most important is that we're always going to stick to humanitarian principles. And that's something that separates kind of the humanitarian space from the rest of the actors that work here, from development actors, other civil society organizations. So we have to be independent and neutral. And so we'll never work in a context or in partnership with the government if that's going to be compromised. So we're not picking sides in the conflict. We're not going to be, you know, kind of politicized or instrumentalized to support their military objectives or their, you know, political objectives. So we have to be able to operate independently. And so that is typically like the most important foundation we have to have. And if that's compromised, then humanitarians have to reconsider, you know, if they can work there. You're always trying to stay and deliver no matter how bad the conditions get and find a way to do it and be creative.
When you go into a country, is it necessary to partner with other NGOs and organizations that do similar work? And if so, how do those relationships work out?
Yes, always. I think partnership is essential in every place that we work. So first, we're working with local partners. And so that's true. Like right now in Lebanon, we're launching emergency responses in partnership with local partners and groups we worked with during the violence in 2024. In Gaza, our work across the board is done with local Palestinian partners we work with to deliver health services and nutrition. So everywhere we work, it has to be in partnership. You never want to come into a context, especially as an international organization, and just try to do it on your own. You have to understand the context. You have to understand community dynamics, you know, what tensions are there, and also who's already doing work in this space. And so that's where we do work with other health actors. We work with the World Health Organization, with local ministries of health, and understand who is here, what services are being provided, what are the needs, and are there gaps? Are there gaps we can provide on our own? Are there ways that we can partner with someone else to magnify the work that they're doing, or something that we can do, you know, better or more efficient or cheaper to help support those efforts? And so we're always making sure that we're not duplicating work. But in every context, it has to be in partnership. And I also say that, you know, as an organization that does health and nutrition, I can think about a place like Gaza, for example. We have done a huge scale up in our malnutrition work since the ceasefire deal. We're reaching tens of thousands of malnourished kids that weren't getting aid before. We're not providing, you know, all the other sectors in the humanitarian response of, you know, doing the large scale food and water and sanitation that other organizations provide. But if those organizations weren't doing those work, then these kids can't recover. You know, they need to have access to clean water. They need to have shelter, you know, and housing to go home to. And so being able to work in partnership with those organizations, have all of us present there working in complementary ways, and what helps people survive and be able to recover. And so that we're each contributing kind of different pieces to the puzzle in very complementary ways.
In addition to having physicians and medical staff, does Med Global also provide like medical supplies to a particular country?
We do, yes. And so we do that in almost everywhere where we work. We'll bring in medical equipment and supplies based on our work with those local hospitals and health centers, where they'll help identify what are the gaps they have, and we'll help procure those internationally for them. And so that's, I think, one of the key gaps that we can fill, and where we have kind of evaluated as an international organization being able to do those logistics.
So of all the countries that Med Global works in currently, are there any that rise to the surface as most critical, most in need right now in 2026?
Yes. So with the funding cuts globally, I will say every place is being hit hard, unfortunately. So this is probably the worst funding crisis of this century that we've had. And so that's a pretty sharp overnight cuts, and it has a ripple effect across every country and every sector. That being said, I think some of the ones that are highest concern, I would say places like, I mean, Gaza, where virtually every single person requires humanitarian aid. It is barely out of famine conditions. still has widespread needs and is, you know, a week or two away from running out of key supplies at any given moment. And so that's a context that has fallen a little bit out of media attention, but is one where at any moment disruptions return to conflict could send it back into famine, back into a really alarming situation pretty quickly. Another one that really concerns me is Sudan. It's the world's largest humanitarian crisis, over 30 million people that need humanitarian aid, and it is deteriorating very fast this year. And so we've seen a number of cities that have been under siege, violence deliberately, you know, targeting civilians, drone warfare attacks on civilians really increasing this year, huge number of displacements that are still happening every month. And it's a crisis that continues to get a fraction of the attention and the resources that it needs.
Oh, yeah, we never hear about Sudan in the news. I don't anyway.
And which is alarming because, again, it's the largest humanitarian crisis, you know, by kind of by miles, and sort of dwarfs, you know, almost any other crisis that we're talking about. And I think especially now with the Middle East escalating, attention rightfully focused on Iran, on Lebanon, and the horrific situation there, places like Sudan fall even lower, kind of on the level of attention that they're getting. And that's one that has not, I think, hit rock bottom yet. And that's what's really scary, is that the violence is really intensifying. People are fleeing, you know, trying to find areas of safety. And it's a country that is also in a region that is extremely fragile right now. And so that's one of the regions that I think is at highest risk of a pretty massive deterioration and regional conflict this year. And I think that the world and donors are not prepared for that. But it has, you know, refugees across the region in countries that are already struggling and already under strain before this happened, regional tensions that are escalating. And so there's a really high likelihood that not only Sudan deteriorates, but the region around it also deteriorates. And then you're talking about almost an unprecedented crisis.
That's Anna Moran, and she serves as the Director of Global Policy and Advocacy at the humanitarian NGO Med Global. And you're listening to us at A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina.
Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, it seems like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say it's all right. Little darling, the smiles return to their faces.
Okay, that's Here Comes the Sun with James Taylor and Yo-Yo Ma. Our guest today is Anna Moran. She works with the NGO Med Global. Anna, to what degree does your position require you to interact directly with a particular country or people in that country, with the medical staff and so on?
So as the director of Med Global's advocacy, a lot of my work is focused on engaging policymakers. So engaging, I'm based in DC, engaging with the Trump administration, with the U.S. Congress, with other governments, to explain to them what's happening on the ground, you know, what are we most concerned about and what can they do to help. And then for all of that work, I'm, you know, working pretty much on a daily basis with our teams on the ground. So speaking with our program teams who are running these emergency responses, who are providing the medical care, to understand what they're seeing, you know, what the trajectory looks like, and the really specific things that they need to do their jobs, whether it's aid that's, you know, stuck at the border, or it's the impact of, you know, the violence and shutdown of flights and how that might be affecting them, or bigger picture issues like needing, you know, ceasefires, you know, kind of another agreements to be able to do their jobs.
Where does Med Global get your funding from?
So we are fortunate to be, you know, supported by kind of a range of donors. So we have great partnerships with different UN agencies, you know, a number of countries where we work with them, as well as kind of private foundations and individual giving. So have been pretty, I think, diversified, and have kind of a range of those like private partners that support us, in addition to some of those, the bigger like UN donors.
Would you say that Med Global differs, or how does it differ from organizations like Doctors Without Borders or the International Medical Corps?
It's a great question. So I think you know, the one thing that, you know, I mentioned earlier that I do think really makes us a bit more unique, you know, is really being focused on kind of the system strengthening and recovery. So I think we're a bit unique in being an organization that does a lot of emergency work. We're working in these conflict zones, but everything we are doing is not with a short-term mindset, but it's how do we support this system to recover? And so even in, you know, places like Gaza, we have that mindset where our goal is for these hospitals, these health centers to be rebuilt, for the doctors in Gaza and Syria and Lebanon, for them to be the ones leading the response. And so we don't go in with a mindset that we're going to be here for 30 years and we're running our own system that's going to be parallel and have our own hospitals and our own health sites. We're really integrated into that local health system. And that goes from like the local doctors that we're working with, you know, and supporting at a given site, to the partnerships with the, you know, the state or federal Ministry of Health that we're working with, so that we are all, you know, coordinated. And what we are doing is designed to kind of have those off ramps to help support that system to take over and lead the health response. So that's one thing that I think that makes us a bit more unique, as well as I think the incredible group of international doctors we have that, you know, volunteer time with us and deploy into all of these settings to provide, you know, their expertise, their trainings, again, with that mindset of helping those systems recover. And so really, I think in places like Syria, for example, we've had incredible work with the diaspora, where we've been a convener in bringing together Syrian doctors who left the country during the war, who have come back to Syria and have supported, you know, our efforts for recovery and volunteering their time and their expertise to come together at the table with us, with the government, with local doctors, you know, these Syrian diaspora doctors, to all kind of work together about how can we help rebuild this system.
Are there certain countries that it's either difficult to find personnel who already live in the country or difficult to recruit people to go?
You know, I think we're lucky to have, you know, in terms of recruiting people to go, I think we have this roster that I mentioned, this kind of network of doctors we work with, are willing to go into all these zones. You know, I think Gaza has been the most dangerous place to be an aid worker in the last 2 years, the deadliest, in a really difficult operating environment. And even there, you know, we have doctors that go back multiple times, you know, and I think that in many places we, you know, have more doctors, you know, wanting to come in than we could probably do even more medical missions if we could, you know, bring everyone in that wants to come. And so I think that's something that I think we're really fortunate that these people are willing to volunteer their time, you know, and take these risks and want to go in and serve in the most difficult conflict zones. Mm-hmm. We did that in Sudan as well. You know, which has again been a really, really volatile, really difficult place. It's a difficult environment to access. And we sent in the first international team into this city in Northern State in a really remote location, and had this group of, you know, American doctors who raised their hands and wanted to do that and came in as the first team to a place where people had fled a besieged city, El Fasher, and had gone months in some cases without medical care. And so they were responding to people with drone injuries, I mean, shrapnel in their bodies that had been in their bodies for weeks, if not months in some cases. You know, and we're just great to, I think, have these doctors who are so generous with their time and want to do this. And immediately after coming out, so many of them like raise their hand and are saying, like, I want to go back again. I mean, when I was in Ukraine, we had, I think, some who've been there like five or six times. The people who they go once and they see the impact they're having, they see the scale of needs, and want to come back and serve on these medical missions again.
Oh, such courageous souls. Hard to imagine people being willing to put themselves at risk like that to serve other people. It's amazing.
It's as awful as these crises are, I think that's the inspiring part. Mm. And you see those partnerships and people stay in touch and they work. Like I was in Ukraine, you know, people who work with these Ukrainian doctors, they stay in touch with them, you know, talk about patients that they're seeing, you know, and can kind of continue that relationship. But that's, I think, the hopeful part. It's as awful as they are, there are incredible people on the ground and incredible people here that are supporting those efforts.
Mm-hmm. So let's move to talk about Gaza, if we could. First of all, has the ceasefire that went into effect in October 2025, has it held?
So the large scale violence, I think I'll start with the positive. The large scale violence, you know, has subsided, and that matters. And I want to start there first, because having that kind of end to like the major military operations, the large scale airstrikes that we were seeing right before the ceasefire, where we were seeing attacks on Gaza City, hundreds of thousands of people displaced. We're not at that point anymore. And that is a positive, and that's progress that matters. You know, Gaza has barely come out of famine, you know, as of December. We were within the first few weeks after that ceasefire deal, as more aid was allowed to come into Gaza, we did a very fast scale up in our malnutrition work. And so there were malnourished kids that had not been treated for weeks beforehand. And we did immediately overnight had like a sevenfold increase in how many, you know, children and women that we were reaching with our malnutrition programs. So that progress matters, like getting that aid in, having places that we can access that were harder to get to before. There's still violence, though. There's still airstrikes. There's still bombings that are happening. There's still violence that happens on the ground. And so the violence hasn't ended. There's still conflict. There's still injuries that are happening. And on top of that, there's still not enough aid in Gaza. And that hasn't changed with the ceasefire deal. It's improved. There's more food that's coming in. There are supplies that are coming in. And we seize every opportunity we can to do more. But it's not enough. And it is a place where pretty much every single person of the 2 million in Gaza needs some kind of humanitarian assistance. And there just isn't enough right now.
I read this report on your website. I think it's from August 2025. And it talked about the significant rise in children's malnutrition, which you had just mentioned. Could you just take a minute and talk about the different levels of malnutrition and what you're seeing in Gaza?
Yes. There are two forms. There's moderate and severe. And so we've seen both forms in Gaza. Moderate malnutrition is what most children have. And with both forms, you can, what's the good news about malnutrition, as awful as it is that it's highly treatable. So with both forms, there are these pretty simple kind of peanut butter based pastes that you can give kids that were designed and fortified with all these vitamins that can help them recover pretty quickly. So it's really one of the cheapest, fastest, easiest interventions that exists in the humanitarian space. And so because of the invention of that, it's called like RUTF, or we call it Plumpy Nut, you know, is one of the brands people know. That you can help kids, you know, most kids will recover if they get treatment. What was alarming last summer when we put out that report and we did nutrition assessments right before the famine classification, where we were seeing levels of malnutrition that indicated famine and put out a report saying so, was that there wasn't enough treatment for these kids. So there wasn't enough food coming in. There wasn't enough clean water. That's what was driving these kids to become malnourished in the first place. But once they got to that point, we should be able to treat them and save every life if we have the supplies that we need. We got to a point, though, where we were running out of those nutrition supplies. We were also running out of the medicine that we needed to help these kids recover. And when we don't have that treatment, and when the underlying conditions are not being addressed, those kids with moderate malnutrition become very likely to deteriorate into kind of the end stage, which is severe malnutrition. With the severe acute malnutrition, that's when you start getting really worried about a whole host of medical complications happening, and where their immune system is so destroyed, their bodies are so weakened, that you start talking about like organs shutting down and pretty serious medical complications. And that's when we start having to hospitalize kids in places like Gaza. So we are one of the biggest nutrition actors in Gaza. And we actually run 2 out of the 5 sites that are capable of hospitalizing those kids when they need that and helping them recover. And we got to a point last summer where even in those sites where we should be able to save each of those kids that we have to admit, we were running out of the medicine we needed to help revive them and help them recover, and started having children die at our clinics for the first time ever in Gaza. Fortunately, we're now, after the deal, like more nutrition has been allowed to come into Gaza. We've been able to do a huge scale up in our nutrition work and are now reaching tens of thousands of kids with that treatment. But they still exist in a wider context where there's increasingly not enough food, not enough clean water. They're living in camps and really kind of poor conditions. And so we're doing this work and we're treating them for malnutrition. But then I see some of these images from our team, you know, the camps that they're living in. And this winter, when it was freezing conditions and there wasn't enough tents being able to come in, tents were being flooded. because there's not enough, you know, sewage systems set up and programs running to get that waste out. And there's open sewage in some of these camps. Those are horrific conditions for anyone to be in. But for a malnourished kid who's trying to recover, whose immune system is compromised, who might have other medical conditions they're trying to recover from, it really stacks the odds against them. And so that's why it's great, the work that we're able to do scale up, and it matters, and it is saving these kids' lives. But the wider aid system needs to be able to operate as well. And these kids need to have that shelter and that food and the clean water and every other component they need to live a healthy life to make sure that they can actually have the recovery that they need.
Well, talk for a minute. I mean, that's the children, but the report also talked about the women that are of reproductive age or girls that are 15 to 19 years of the rate of malnutrition is significant with them.
It is. And again, we've seen, like, since the ceasefire deal, we've seen some of these improvements where some of these malnutrition levels are going down, thankfully. But it still takes time. So pregnant women and the young girls are particularly vulnerable populations, where if they're not getting enough nutrition, you know, for a pregnant woman, it's affecting that woman's health, you know, in her body and her immunity, you know, to diseases and other things. But it also means that for a baby that's, you know, growing in a pregnancy during famine conditions, and we put out that report, it was famine conditions. And so those babies are now being born this fall, this winter, the babies are being born that went through those famine pregnancies. And those babies are more likely to be born underweight, you know, malnourished themselves. I mean, we had babies we were treating that were only weeks old and are already malnourished. So extremely vulnerable. And so that's, you know, if you can make sure these women get the care they need during pregnancy, you can stop that cycle in its tracks. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're trying to do now, you know, and make sure that pregnant women and others can get that care throughout their pregnancy or getting access to food, access to the nutrients to prevent that from happening. Because otherwise you have these children that are beginning their lives malnourished. And again, with all the conditions I talked about, where the risk of disease is higher, the risk of those illnesses, I mean, during winter, even just getting a cold, those things can be a death sentence for a child that's malnourished. And so you're operating in a pretty high-risk environment for any kid to be malnourished. So that's where we're trying to stop that, prevent it in the first place, so that you never get to that point where that child, that infant, is malnourished on top of everything else that they're dealing with.
So these babies that are born malnourished, can they be helped?
Yes. And so again, that is the most positive thing about all of this, is that malnutrition is highly treatable. If you have the supplies you need, you have the treatment, we can treat these cases. And so right now, we have the nutrition supplies that we need. We're able to do, to scale up that nutrition work, to reach a pregnant woman, to reach these kids. But you have to have consistent aid supplies. That is the most important thing. And if you have disruptions, if you have periods where aid's not going into Gaza, that is when you start seeing the kids dying. And that's why last summer there were headlines with the images of these malnourished children, the reports that were coming out about children dying. None of that is inevitable. That's not just like the way it is or what happens during war or in conflicts. Like in 2026, we have the tools. We've invented the treatments we need to help these kids. Not a single child should die from malnutrition in the 21st century. But again, all of that is, aid has to be allowed in. So these are political decisions, but we can do our jobs as humanitarians.
Are you aware of any estimates of how many children or people lost their lives due to not having food to eat?
It's a good question. I think everything in Gaza is likely an undercount. I think the number of people that have died over the 2+ years of conflict, the number of people that died during the famine, I think all of those numbers, it will take years to know how bad it was. And I say that because that's what was true in other contexts. So I'll give an example of the last kind of large scale famine that happened was in Somalia in 2011. I mean, there's been famine declarations in Sudan and South Sudan on smaller scales, but the last large scale one, like what was happening in Gaza, and that it took about 2 years before there's a report that documented and mapped out kind of how many people had died. And it's because in places where you don't have access to these communities, there's violence that's happening, you know, places where the health system has collapsed, you have children and women that are dying in these camps that are not, you know, being buried in graves where you just don't have those numbers in front of you, and it takes time. And in a place like Gaza, with how much destruction there is, the scale of that violence, how many aid workers have been killed, how many hospitals have shut down, and kind of the formal care system has been compromised, it's going to take, I think, a long time. And it will be a multi-year process to understand the full scale of how bad that it was. And I think especially with the health system being destroyed the way it has been, it's just all of those registrations of babies being born, babies that have died, all of that, that the documentation takes time to get. And so I think, I mean, we saw children dying in our clinics last summer. So we knew how bad it was, and we were starting to see those estimates and warning about how bad it was going to get. Certainly if the ceasefire deal hadn't happened, I think we would be talking about much higher numbers. We'd be talking, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people dying. But I think for now, I think I couldn't give a good estimate just because of how bad the access and the violence was.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. And our guest today is Anna Moran. She's with the humanitarian NGO Med Global. And we'll return with Anna in just a few minutes after this break.
I'll tell you a story. Make it clear as I can about the faraway troubles in the Holy Land. Pictures of the children etched in your mind, buried in the rubble of the firing line. Jews and Arabs, the living one and the same, for 1,000 years before the Zionists came. And they came like a river, and they came like a flood. The people calling it the Nakba, cause that's what it was. Oh, Palestine, going home. About the settlers that come from so far away, and talk about the money from the USA. Talk about the bullets and made of plastic and lead, in the shadows of a boot heel over your head. Now what do you do?
Okay, that's Jim Page singing Palestine from his album Collateral Damage. And our guest today on A Better World is Anna Moran. She's a foreign policy expert with decades of experience advocating on humanitarian crises and development needs in conflict-affected settings. And she currently serves as the Director of Global Policy and Advocacy at the humanitarian NGO Med Global. Before the break, Anna, we were talking about children and women and malnutrition. What's the situation with the healthcare system in Gaza today in 2026?
It's still incredibly weak. So we should be in a period of large-scale recovery. I think the ceasefire deal gives an opportunity for that. But most of the health system was attacked, you know, and has some degree of damage. A number of hospitals and health centers shut down entirely. You know, we're forced out of operation. So 2 million people do not have the scale of health services that they need. There is recovery efforts that have started. You know, we are supporting a number of health sites and hospitals. We run, you know, nutrition like stabilization centers and other sites ourselves. And so we've been able to scale up some of that. But really the number one problem, in addition to the damage, has been supply issues. So there are still very alarming shortages in basic supplies in Gaza. So I hear constantly from our team, particularly about the stockouts of medicine that is needed. So even though there's food, there's other stuff that, you know, is coming into Gaza. It's not enough. Really across the board, you can pick any item, fuel, food, shelter, you know, any of those items. There's not enough coming in right now. And it's gotten worse since the escalation in the Middle East and border crossing closures in Gaza. But the medical system, I think, is hit particularly hard. So our team, you know, talks about really alarming shortages in the medicine for just chronic conditions. So things that should not be an emergency. So someone that has diabetes or high blood pressure or heart disease, someone who just needs this routine medicine and could be living a fairly normal life, because a lot of that medicine is in alarming shortages or even stocked out in some cases, those patients can't get the basic care they need. And those people become at risk of turning into emergency situations. So it's not even talking about, you know, airstrike victims, you know, people that are in the ICU for that, but just kind of the routine medical care that we take for granted, you know, to have in the US. That's what's really alarming right now, because there's just not enough of that medicine and other medical supplies coming into Gaza yet.
For a long time during this conflict, a lot of those supplies were waiting at the border, say coming in from Egypt or wherever. Is that still the case? Are there still long lines of supply trucks waiting to get in?
Yes, there's still, and you know, some in trucks, some in sitting in warehouses. There's still a huge amount of aid that could come into Gaza if it was allowed. And so I think it's important to note, you know, humanitarian organizations like MedGlobal are still there. We still have, you know, our offices, our sites, the hospitals running. We still have all of our staff on the ground, you know, ready to scale up the second aid comes in. So NGOs have not left. They're there. We have aid that's, you know, paid for by donors, you know, generously supported. The problem is getting the aid into Gaza. That across the board, there's just not enough on any given week that's allowed to come in. I think we saw that as the crisis in the Middle East was escalating just in the last 2 weeks, you know, for example, the border crossings into Gaza were temporarily all shut down. And what was really alarming to me was seeing, it was kind of a reminder of just how close we are to running out of supplies at any given moment. Organizations like the World Central Kitchen that runs, you know, kitchens across Gaza providing meals would have run out within a week if a crossing didn't reopen. The World Food Program, which is kind of the largest procurer of bringing, you know, food into Gaza, had 2 weeks worth of supplies before they would have run out. And so that's even for what aid is allowed to come in. It's not enough. And that means that Gaza is left in a pretty vulnerable position where, I mean, now one crossing has reopened, some aid is allowed in. It's still about, I think, a third of what is needed on any given day. But as we think about these global supply chain disruptions, the risk of the ripple effects from the Middle East, what that may look like, a place like Gaza is kind of on the edge of a cliff that it can't afford if crossings close, if supply chains get disrupted, you know, if there's funding shortages, it is, you know, days away from running out of different kinds of food, medical supplies, commodities. And so that's a really vulnerable position for 2 million people to be in.
Is there a patient or family story from Gaza that comes to mind that's had an impact on you?
I think consistently, I mean, the two things I would say, I think the first crisis I've worked on where I'm very aware of the impact for my colleagues. And in every context, you know, it's like aid workers are often, especially in conflict zones, they're responding to the crisis. They're being first responders. You know, they're treating patients, but they're almost always affected themselves. And that's been, I think, really true in Gaza, though more so than any other crisis I've worked on, where most of our staff have been displaced. You know, for many of them, their homes have been destroyed. You know, during the famine last summer, you know, they're more privileged people in society. Like they have jobs, they have income from MedGlobal, but you know, we can't control everything. And when markets collapse, when no food, you know, is coming in, they're impacted just like everybody else. And so I think that has been what's been really different on Gaza. You know, we were talking to your colleagues and they don't have enough access to food, you know, and are talking about, you know, what's going to happen and where their homes are being destroyed when they're being displaced again for the second or third or fourth time and fleeing with their families, with their parents, while trying to run a response and help thousands of people. But I think in addition, just to the like incredible work that my team is doing in the worst possible conditions and some of the worst moments of their lives, I think it's the malnourished children, I think, has been the hardest part of this. You know, and children that have been born into this conflict in the last 2 years, you know, who start their lives malnourished. You know, I think about like a story from our team, you know, this year about like a 2-year-old that has cancer and is also fighting malnutrition. So there's a 2-year-old girl named Her who, you know, you think about cancer is already like unimaginable to have to deal with that with your toddler. And this child is fighting cancer while they're also trying to fight malnutrition. Mm-hmm. And so I think about a story like that, where, you know, we know here in the US, I think especially from COVID, you know, from everything you're reminded, like people with a compromised immune system, you know, you have to be so careful with their care, even a cold, the flu could be deadly. And malnutrition, what it does is destroy your immune system. And so I think about a kid like that who's trying to fight two medical battles, and just one of them was in, you know, the world's control. Like malnutrition never needs to happen. It's completely preventable. It's entirely kind of a man-made artificial crisis. And so I think about like a child like that kind of patient who never should be in that, have been put in that position. And like, thankfully, like that child is able to get to a medical clinic. We're able to provide malnutrition treatment to them and help them recover from the malnutrition, you know, that they're facing. But I think those are the kinds of stories that are frustrating because, you know, these kids shouldn't be, should never have been in that place. You know, I think of a child like that, again, who was like born into this conflict, or they, you know, wasn't even born, you know, in 2023 when this all started. And all that child has known has been 2 years, you know, of violence and conflict. And so I think those are the stories when you see the way that kids are impacted and the trauma that they're going through right now is what is really hard.
That's Anna Moran. She's with us today on A Better World, and she's the Director of Global Policy and Advocacy at the humanitarian NGO MedGlobal. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. Okay, that's an Aramaic rendition of the Our Father. And our guest today is Anna Moran. She's with the NGO MedGlobal. Anna, so does MedGlobal work in the West Bank?
No, we're just in Gaza.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier, I'd like for you to kind of talk about what you're doing in Lebanon, considering the crisis that's going on in there. And you've mentioned Syria, too. So if you could kind of give us a bit more detail about what's happening with MedGlobal there.
Certainly. So yes, we respond, responding both in Syria and Lebanon. I'll start with Lebanon because I think certainly is being hit the hardest. We've been in Lebanon since 2020. We started operations after the Beirut port explosion, and have maintained a consistent presence since then, providing, you know, health assistance, across the board, you know, for these last 6 years. We're responding in 2024 when their violence escalated and conflict started, and we're responding again with emergency services that we're scaling up now. What has been different this time compared to past responses in Lebanon has been just the pace of the crisis. And I think that's what it's hard to put into words and explain, just how, I think, unbelievable the scale and speed is. It's over 800,000 people displaced in about 10 days. We, you know, estimate, I think that it's actually closer to 1 million people that are displaced. So it's about 1 in 5 people in Lebanon that have had to flee their homes you know, pretty much overnight and sometimes with no warning, you know, grab what they can and go. So what we're responding to is that displacement and filling the gaps of life-saving things that people don't have. You know, so we, our team has been, for example, you know, working with a lot of people, especially elderly people who fled and don't have the medication that they need. So for example, our team, you know, supported this week a woman who's almost 90 who doesn't have any living family, who fled in her car and didn't have the medication she needed for diabetes and blood pressure. And so we helped get access to medication for her. But that's a lot of the families we're responding to. There's another case of, you know, a woman who has a teenager who's paralyzed and they had to flee without his wheelchair, you know, because it came, this happened so suddenly, you know, and people are fleeing at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., grabbing their kids in their pajamas, you know, and trying to find a place that's safe. Because of just how large scale this is and how fast it is deteriorating every day, the shelters got full within the first few days. So there's about 100,000 people that are in the shelters. So that means for every one person that's in a shelter, there's at least 7 or 8 that aren't in one. And so those people are sleeping in their cars or they're sleeping on the streets or trying to find a relative or some safe place that they can go to get shelter. So even that, just the most basic, where are you sleeping tonight, is hard for most people. So we're providing, you know, mattresses, you know, trying to, like, winter clothing for people. Like, it's still winter. It is cold for people to be sleeping outside or sleeping in tents. Providing that medication for so many people who fled and then have realized, like, they don't have, you know, the medication they needed. People who don't know how long they're going to be displaced, when they might be able to go back to their home. And then working with some of the more, like, particularly vulnerable populations, like pregnant women, infants who need specialized care, who, if they need baby formula and bottles, like clean water for baby formula, all those things you need, like, every day that you take for granted, that people don't have when they had to flee so suddenly. And so we're helping fill a lot of those gaps for these displaced families right now across Lebanon.
Are you experiencing in Lebanon and Syria the same supply that you've experienced in Gaza, or can you get supplies in there?
So not, we don't have the supply issues like we have in Gaza. So fortunately, we're able to be distributing supplies to people, you know, in Lebanon right now. That said, I think the displacement is happening faster than the humanitarian response can catch up. And that is just because, again, 800,000 people, a million people displaced in 10 days is extraordinary. And to keep up with that, to find out where people are going, to get them registered, takes time. But we'd have, it's, you know, almost 100,000 people being displaced a day, you know, in those first few days. And so trying to keep up with that, to have 1 in 5 people displaced, like, that requires, like, an unbelievable scale up to happen. And so it's just a matter of keeping up with that. But where we are going to get concerned about those supply chains, I think that's the secondary shock of this. So it's like right now everyone's focused on the immediate of the injuries that are happening, the health system, you know, that's under attack right now, you know, centers that are having to close, trying to fill those gaps, respond to people that are displaced. The secondary impacts, though, are going to be the next crisis that we have to worry about. And that won't just be Lebanon or Syria. That will be global. And so as we think about the implications we're already seeing from the Strait of Hormuz, closing, what that's doing, I mean, we already see it here with oil prices, you know, gas prices rising. The concern is, though, that weeks and months from now, we're going to be talking not just about higher fuel prices, but food prices and everything else that's being shipped globally. And so that has the potential to affect supply chains really everywhere. And so for Lebanon, a place where the majority of the population has been in poverty, a country that has been reeling from economic crisis, it's a huge problem already that a lot of people can't afford, you know, basic items. And that's why we're doing the work that we're doing. Like, their inflation is a huge problem there. So that's why we are getting medication for people and mattresses and basic things to help them get through this right now. A lot of people can't afford that when they had to leave their home. And so there's already that cost right now. As costs go up, when there are supply chain disruptions and food prices get even more expensive, when fuel gets more expensive, that's when we have to start being concerned about what does that mean for hospitals that need fuel for their generators to keep running, for ambulances that need to keep running. It makes the cost of the humanitarian response go up. It makes the cost for every person we're supporting go up. It means more and more people are going to require humanitarian aid because now they have been priced out of the grocery store, of going to the gas station, and they need our support to get by. Lebanon's going to be hit very hard by that if it happens, but it also will be catastrophic for other places that we're working. So places like Syria, that's in a very fragile recovery, but still has extremely high poverty rates, can't afford that kind of economic shock. You know, people are still displaced. People are just starting to return to their homes. The risk of having, you know, returnees coming home. I mean, Syria has already had more than 80,000 Syrian refugees go from Lebanon back to Syria. People that don't necessarily have a home to go to are going back to communities that were destroyed. Services that are already, overwhelmed and can't absorb more people coming back prematurely, weren't ready to do so. Syria is going to be contending with that, and that could get, you know, much, much worse. And then there's other places that we work that are much further away that are not in the media right now, but places like Sudan, places like Yemen, that have fallen out of media headlines, but have a huge amount of displacement and humanitarian need. For example, a place like Yemen, 90% of their food gets imported. That's a country that's in a very precarious position. If supply chains get disrupted, if the cost of fuel and food goes up, a place like Yemen is going to be hit harder than almost anywhere else in the world. And so that's when we're very focused on places like Lebanon right now, the regional impact. But very soon we could be talking about this ripple effect that is affecting tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of the most vulnerable people around the world who are not going to be able to absorb that kind of shock. And so that's going to be putting even more of a strain on the humanitarian services. We'll have more and more people that need the kind of services MedGlobal provides. And we're at a point where aid cuts have been forcing programs to close and reduce in so many places around the world. So to have that kind of unprecedented need, the very real risk that we're talking about famines in multiple countries later this year, like those are the worst case scenarios. And we're at a point where the funding has not been provided this year to meet the existing need. And so we're not prepared for those kinds of crises to deteriorate. And so all of that kind of brings even more urgency for this conflict to end as soon as possible, because we're barely 2 weeks into it and it already has displaced millions of people and created this huge shock to the region. If it goes on longer than this, we are talking about these global ramifications for refugees and displaced people all around the world.
So for people who have a need or a desire to want to help, do you have any suggestions for how they might do something to help the situation where you'd work, like in Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and Sudan, or elsewhere?
Well, I'll be biased in promoting MedGlobal. You know, one of the most, I think, immediate things you can do is like support a humanitarian organization that's responding. And so if you're interested in supporting MedGlobal, you can go to our website, you know, medglobal.org, and donate to support our work in any of these contexts. And, you know, places like Gaza and Lebanon, where services are so stretched right now, there's huge gaps in need. Like those donations have a huge impact right now, and will translate this week, next week, into helping real families on the ground. But encourage you to support, whether it's MedGlobal or other humanitarian NGOs that you know, like helping them right now as they're dealing with a huge kind of unprecedented needs this year and a really dire funding crisis. And I also encourage people to, you know, contact your representatives. And I know with everything that is happening right now, I very much understand that feels frustrating. And I'm sure people have done that, have called their representatives on a variety of issues. But it's important that people sustain that, to put pressure on them to bring this conflict to an end, and also calling for them, you know, to increase like the U.S. humanitarian support for all of these crises. And so that's the other half that I also encourage people to keep up that momentum and that drumbeat, and telling people you care about what's happening in Lebanon and also in places that have fallen off the attention, places like Gaza, so that they know people are still paying attention, people care, and people are demanding answers about, you know, what their government is doing and how it's helping.
MedGlobal does great work, and anybody that wants to know more about their work around the world, check out their website. They've got a lot of good information on it. And I want to thank Anna Moran for being our guest today from MedGlobal. Anna, thank you for the work you do, and all the best to you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Waiting for a Miracle from Jerry Garcia.
Working and waiting in the hot sun. With all the rich saints and the fallen ones. Working and waiting for the night to come.